It's a radio 89.7 FM. This is Arts Monday, Simpo Easy, streaming to you from the Gadigal land of the Eora Nation. My name is Ira, and I am starting a call to the artistic director of the Living Room Theatre, Michelle Saint-Anne, to talk about their latest production, The Seeping Woman, soon showing at the Gladstone Hotel in Dulwich Hill. A collaboration with digital artist Linda Dement, dancer Anka Frankenhauser, and musicians Mary Rapp and Nikki Johnson, the work focuses on gestures both human and digital, held within the seepage of fluids, fabric, and observations. Like all living room theater works, The Seeping Woman gives voice to the unspoken, unseen, and the uncomfortable. It uses a non-linear form and is composed through movement, digital projections, sound, and the overall atmosphere, rather than the rigidity of the given language. It speaks to the logic of the body rather than the mind. Michelle, do we have you on the line?
You do. Good morning, Ira.
Good morning, Michelle. Where are we finding you this morning as you speak to us? What surrounds you?
Oh, I'm in my attic in my Dulwich Hill home. So I'm right under the flight path. So I do apologize. We might get some aircraft noise and also some very loud magpies who are in the tree outside.
And is this your studio space, the space where you create your works before you go into the actual studio to the floor?
Yes, it is. It's my desk. I've got my setup here with my little boom amplifier and my cups of tea and computer. So it is where I actually do my writing. So I usually write from pen on paper, and then I will come back and type that into my computer where I do some of my editing. And I have my little black and white cat, Bok Choy, sitting behind me. He's having a sleep on a little red velvet chair, which was my mother's.
You mentioned writing on paper with pen, and I'm curious about this methodology, this choice to use this tactile material as you start writing. What is the difference between that and writing digitally straight away?
Oh, I love, as you said, the tactile nature of pen and paper. I feel like it's more of an emotional attachment when you're dreaming and you can then scribble. So it's more drawing, the art of drawing, as opposed to the communication mode of writing. So that means if I can't articulate something, I could sketch something very quickly, usually around staging. So I know where people are or where I want to place people in space, so I can quickly write that down, draw that out, as opposed to typing it out or writing it down in stage directions.
Mm-hmm. Currently, you are deep in the development and rehearsal for your new work, The Seeping Woman, which is showing at the Gladstone Hotel in Dulwich Hill in a few days on April the 10th.
Yes, correct.
And before we dive deep into the fine details of this work, what could you tell us about it in a few brief notes? What is an overarching premise or a tagline of the work, if this is a fair way to talk about it?
Yes, it's a difficult question for me because at this moment in time, she has remained quite disparate. So I have a broad concept of the idea that women of a certain age remain unseen in contemporary society, but because they have pioneered and are the giants and the shoulders that we stand on, like given our parents, our mothers particularly, there is a seepage of their bodies in the world that they have created for us. So I think that's the tensions that I'm looking at, the legacy of these women, but also the pain that they are often unseen and unrecognized for the world that they have carved out for younger women.
When you speak about their seepage into the world, what are some of the ways that they seep in?
I guess a lot of that seepage for me is the strength that my mother has left for me. So I recently lost my mother, and I just remember that moment when she was no longer in this world physically, how big the world became and how small I felt in it. And as grief has changed shape and texture for me, I've realized that she has very much left a lot of the strength that she needed and the resilience that she needed in her own life has actually seeped into my own. And so where I physically miss her, I have very much have her inside my body in various forms. And when I think about the physical world and how women move in the physical world, that we learn to make ourselves smaller, and we spend a lot of time negotiating a male-oriented world. I see the seepage in the way that we move furniture or move around in public spaces, and to me that is seeping, because we do it very quietly and often in unseen or unarticulated ways.
Once the idea for this kind of work comes to you, what happens next in your methodology? What is the process like? Do you go and, as you say, journal, write with the pen on paper, maybe start dreaming or imagining some stage images? Do you talk to other people? Do you create a mood board of some sort? What is this initial process of developing the idea before it goes onto the stage and before you include other people?
Yeah, this one was a very different project. So yes, normally my world is I'm not a private maker, meaning I don't sit in my home and do, you know, create mood boards, and my walls aren't full of, you know, my scribbles and things like that. I actually like to sit out in the world and watch people. I'm a serial people watcher. I really love it. I love watching shapes. I love the way people cross roads. I love the way people in cafes set out their food in front of them. And all of these sorts of things, I sort of really suck in and digest it. And then that sort of presents itself in an image, and it can come to me in really random form. So I received a digital fellowship, like a small digital fellowship with Critical Path, and I was given Linda Dement as my mentor, my digital mentor, and so it was really about that. That's how it kind of started, a really kind of academic approach. I wanted to understand how a digital, what is a digital relationship to the way that I make work and the way that I view work and how people view my work. So I was kind of that lens. I was really looking at that, the thrust between those two lenses. And so it was really about trying to understand who Linda was. So this is kind of our baby, in a way. We sort of started a conversation about, well, what is digital? What was her kind of palette like? What was my palette like? And then we were able to present a tiny prototype for Live Dreams, Performance Spaces Live Dreams. So it was interesting, because all we had was, I just said to her, it's called the Seeping Woman. I like the idea of sweat. I like the idea of a woman sitting alone in a bar drinking something cold in a glass that was then condensing. So you get the condensation around the glass. So everything was kind of, I guess, seeping. And so she created, just from those conversations, she created some sort of apparatus, put together this apparatus in her home and had ink splatting. And she created this basically ink splat video that was shot from above and treated it with the green tinge of the TAB signage that was in the pub at the Dulwich Hill pub where we were kind of trying to create this work. And I know you're probably thinking, why is it in this pub? It's a typical old kind of suburban bar, and but pubs are just generally, that kind of era of pub is generally a male space. But when you go into the sports bar, it is incredibly male. The women are incredibly small who may be there, who've really shrunk down, and the men are just full of, you know, harsh language and big voices. And I kind of thought, what would it be like to pierce that space with my work? And which is where the Seeping Woman was placed. I decided, she's going to be created in this space, so that in a way the men in the space had to rearrange themselves for me, or rather my dream, my actual work. So it's this interesting kind of tension I've kind of tried to flip.
So the space works as a character in the piece.
Correct. Yeah. In fact, I would say she's the largest character. She dictates where we move, how we move, even like where the digital work was. So, you know, Linda and myself were working in a studio, and we said, okay, the tension point is over here. And then when we went into the sports bar and we put it up, we realised, oh, there's an air conditioning unit that runs the line of the pub. So architecturally, that was the anchor. So we then adjusted the digital to balance the weight in the room. So, everything about the space and the way we land in the space is dictated by the relationships between the ensemble and space and temperature.
Tell me more about the temperature. How are you working? Because lots of the living room theater works, for those who haven't had a chance to experience them, beside being site-specific and interested in the interaction between what's on stage, in quotations, and the architecture of the space, your works are often multisensory, so you do work with more than just visual or audio. And you're speaking about temperature now, so yes, tell us more.
Yeah, so when you, so I, in this sports bar, I actually run jazz nights, improvised jazz nights. And what I noticed is sitting under the air conditioning vent, you get these bursts of cold air because it's an old system. And so I really love this idea that the space is warm upon entering, and it then changes temperature throughout the actual work. So this idea that this room also can be adjusted so that we have, there's a different temporality amongst the bodies in space, whether upon entering, then as a group, how do we feel? And then as individuals within that group, we all have different body temperature. So, you know, I'm a menopausal woman, so I'm constantly hot. And, you know, my husband's a tall, thin guy, and he's constantly cold. So even the way that we experience rooms together are different. And I guess by playing with temperature in that room, it almost heightens that experience. And so in itself, it becomes part of the emotional landscape that I'm trying to carve.
From what you're describing, I'm imagining this work being 360 rather than being stage frontally.
Yes, it absolutely is. It's exactly like you walk into a pub. You just take your seat wherever that is. The stage is everywhere and nowhere, which is something that I've always really loved to play with, because I'm interested in not necessarily all that happens in front of you, but what comes up behind you or what you can see in your peripheral vision. And as an audience, as conducting an audience on what to see, I like playing with that. What do they choose to see? So if you're musically inclined, you might have your back towards the digital world and watch the musicians. But if you love film and you love things as presentation, you might turn around this way and watch the video and hear the music from behind. So I'm constantly playing with those tensions. And then the bodies in the space, the musicians as musicians but also as performers, can also move around that space, and they might change instruments or they might pick up an instrument and move it to another space so that there's a different sound quality coming depending on where it's situated in space.
And within this kind of work, what is the role of the audience? What is expected of us as we take this work in?
Yeah, so I've got two kind of rules that I've given myself to stretch audiences' ability to receive work. So it's not about being passive, and it's not about sitting down and playing that power dynamic of entertain me. So it takes away that critical edge of how we receive art. But it becomes more of a co-authorship. So the balance of power is in between the two forms. As you receiving it, you have to bring yourself to my work. I don't think my work really helps. It doesn't work for people to sit outside the work, because then you're going to find everything that's wrong with it, because we're so used to the structures, right, theatrical structures or musical structures or dance choreographic structures. And in a way, I like to create works that are more like landscapes. My German dramaturg David Rosner said, you know, Heiner Goebbels always talks about his work as landscapes, because you don't look at a landscape and go, well, why is that tree there? It's just a given. And in my way, I call it dream logic. You know, we wake from a stupor and we go, well, that happened. It made me feel in this particular way. It's made me think about or reflect on my life in a particular way. And I guess that's what I want my theatre to do, to stretch the way that we see the world and view the world and reflect on the world. But you have to bring your own imagination to it, and I think in these times we don't really exercise our imagination.
You're on ESED Radio 89.7 FM. This is Arts Monday Sympoiesis, and we are in conversation with the artistic director of the Living Room Theatre, Michelle Santin, talking about their latest work, The Seeping Woman, which will be shown at the Gladstone Hotel in Dulwich Hill on 10th of April, so in a few days. Michelle, the Living Room Theatre works defy the disciplinary boundaries, and they are far from the conventional theatre, as you're describing, in the way that they don't have linear structure or narrative arc, but are often told through movement and sound. And in this work, The Seeping Woman, you are working with a dancer, Anka Frankenhauser. What can you tell us about this particular collaboration? What drew you to Anka's body?
Oh, she's extraordinary, isn't she? So Anka, I used to see Anka around, you know, when you'd go and see a show and I'd see her in the audience. And it was only after I'd worked with Linda Dement on this project for a while, and I was working part-time at Carriage Works, and I'd gone off to see a panel discussion, and she was just sitting there in the auditorium. And we caught each other's gaze. She doesn't remember catching my gaze, but I distinctly remember catching the gaze and thinking, I think you're my seeping woman. And there was something about the fragility of her, but also her incredible strength. And I just went off that. That's when I went off. I think Ira, I think I wrote to you and said, hey, Erie, do you know Anka can you, do you have some details of her? And then you shared the details with her, and then she contacted me. And so, yeah, she's been only on my floor 3 times now. So it is a ruthless collaboration. And the most amazing thing about Anka is her generosity of her skill as a physical storyteller, but her imagination. I don't have to give her a lot for her to work really hard about, I think this is what it means to me. You saying that, this is what I think it means to me. And then she will create this world, and I then have the ability to tune it or shape it in a particular way.
What is an example of some of the things that you give her?
Well, I think her very first rehearsal, I said to her, I want you to sit on this chair, and you have your, it's as if something's annoying you on your left shoulder, so you have to wriggle your left shoulder, and I'm projecting some ink that's hitting your body, and I want you to just recognize that. It was that she didn't even know what it looked like because the projector was right in her face. But her inner dialogue just created this incredible tension between the internal and external world. So, and that, I thought that was really interesting because she didn't ask me what the story was. At this point, she didn't even know what the story was. She just arrived and said, okay, I'll take my shoes off, put my socks on, sat on a chair, and then I gently said to her, okay, can you pick up your chair and move along the projection, the back wall? But it was the way that she picked up the chair. All of a sudden, she let her imagination sit in a world where she didn't really know what it was, but she let herself feel the darkness of the room and the shifting of the light of the projector. And that's because she was so open to everything that was happening in the room. And that's incredible. That's incredible generosity to give a maker like me, to say, I'm going to give you time. I'm going to make you an offer so that I give you the time to shape it without asking a lot of questions. And it's interesting because now we're further along the track, we're asking more questions.
Mm-hmm.
But that's really generous of her, I thought, to say, okay, I'll make this offer and I'll make this offer. And then I would just try and pull more and more away from her. So I'm quite amazed by stillness, like physical performers who are incredibly still fascinate me because of this internal dialogue that they can create. So you have beautiful tension.
And you say that now, you know, the third time that you're together in the studio, more questions come up. What are some of the questions that are coming up now?
Why? Everyone asks me why. And I love that question because it's very annoying. It's very irritating when you're working on a very tight time frame. You don't always have everybody in the room. In fact, we have never at this point been in the room together, the whole ensemble. And you don't have a stage manager and you don't have a tech. You have to do everything yourself. But it makes you think deeply about the connection between the elements that doesn't necessarily have to be logical, but it has to be cohesive so that the audience and the ensemble can find connections between what we're bringing together. And answering the why question, Anka and Linda and Nikki have not made me answer that while I'm on the floor. They're quite happy for me to go away and think about it and then come back and say, okay, so this is why I think this isn't working, or this is why I think it's working, and I bring the logic in that way, if that makes sense.
It does. I'm, however, also remembering you telling me once how a lot of your process is very intuitive. And in that intuitive making, the question why could be quite hard to answer, because sometimes not even you clearly understand why from that logical point of view.
Correct.
But I can understand, being a performer in your work once, how that question for me was important in a way of needing to find an image or a sensation in my body that I need to carry as I'm performing your work, and understanding this why enabled me to come in touch with that image.
Yes. Exactly. And I think, yes, the intuition is there, but sometimes what I found, and probably, you know, post working with me, is that saying it's intuitive is not fair on the people that work with me. So I can say, because it feels right, and that's great, that's that satisfaction for me, but that can be very unsatisfying for those that I work with, and also incredibly frustrating and therefore detrimental. So it's kind of nice in this particular work where, you know, what I'm presenting on the 10th of April is not a finished work. It will be a finished experience, a completed experience, but it's not a finished work. And so I'm not putting that pressure on me to present it in that particular way. And therefore, I can pull things together and say, intuitively, that works. And then I've got time before the next rehearsal to really contemplate and think that through, in order to give the ensemble something further for them to hang on to, so that they don't get frustrated. So that was a huge learning curve for me.
Given that you're saying that it's not a finished work, that's what we will experience on the 10th, does that mean that there will be more showings at the Gladstone Hotel in the future, or are you seeing it somewhere else eventually?
Yeah, I want to complete it and then see how she moves in different types of spaces. So even presenting her in a way, maybe back at the Gladstone, but without music and without digital and just with Anka in concert with whoever just happens to be in the space at the time, at a different time of date. So you take the theatrics out of it and you rely on the theatrics of the performer to agitate the space. I'd also like to take the work and put it into a traditional theatre setting to see what the work does with theatrical lighting, because that gives you a different type of control of shaping space, not necessarily at like a Prosarch stage, but I'd love to have the kind of infrastructure of a black box with beautiful lights to play with, and then I'd like to see it more of in a concert form. I think that would be really interesting. So yeah, but these presentation platforms is kind of interesting to me in this next phase of my career, I think.
We will speak about music soon, but before we go there, I also want to mention that the work has a text that you are writing, and knowing your process in your work from the past, I'm imagining that this text is not a script or a narrative device, but something more poetic. Can you speak a bit about the use of text, the function of text?
Yeah, so Picasso says, I found a quote of Picasso when I went to see his exhibition a few years ago, probably a decade or so now, at the Art Gallery of New South Wales. And it was along the lines of, if you want to take somebody over there, you need to give them something that they know, and then you can lead them there. And I think my work when I was a younger maker was a little bit too obscure. So I would leave people out. And of course, I loved that. I mean, I loved that as an audience member, but I realized that that can be kind of agitating. And as my work looks at really important themes of violence and trauma and the female body, I didn't want to isolate those who did come to see my work. So I use text almost like a coat hanger that sits in parts of the work, and so that people can kind of hang themselves on and bring themselves to the work with something that's familiar. Doesn't necessarily mean it's prescriptive, but it could be just a recurring phrase that people kind of go, oh, okay, I think I know what's going on. And then I might shift that away and take them over there to say, is this what that language means? Is that what that word means? And then I might move them over there and say, or does this that word mean this to you, and present it in a different form.
So it creates a rhythm or musicality or melody for the piece.
It's a melody. Yeah, it's definitely a melody. Yes. And for this particular one, I'm actually using text from letters from that I found in my mother's suitcase when I was going through things when she passed. And I found all my letters to her when I was I went to India for 3 months when I was 18, and I just found a whole wad of letters that I'd written to her. But then behind that were other letters from a priest, but my family are Catholic and were deeply religious. And when Mum migrated to Australia, she kept up this friendship with this priest because she grew up in a convent. She was put in a boarding school from age 2 to 21. So she grew up with nuns, with her two older sisters were nuns. And so she had a strong relationship with a mother superior, who I remember being Mother Blander, and then this older priest who I suppose provided counsel to her. And it was in these letters that I realised that she suffered from depression, which is something that I never knew. And the way he wrote to her was interesting because I started to know my mother in a way that I'd never seen before. And it was interesting finding out about my mother through the male gaze. And so I've lifted some of these pieces of text so that we understand the seeping woman through the male gaze.
Wow. And how does the text appear in the work? Is it something that Anka speaks, or is it written and incorporated in the video projection?
It's actually spoken by me. So I speak through microphone because I love microphones. I love the idea about the microphone amplifying something that's very private. And I haven't as yet finalised what is said and when it's said. But I know that a particular statement is going to be repeated because I really love Steve Reich, and I love repetition because, yes, it has its own melody and it becomes part of escape where you almost stop listening to it because it's just repeated. And so you you don't, you've latched onto it, you've heard it a couple of times, it seeps into your imagination, and then the image of whatever is happening in the room starts to then be coloured by that interaction between my voice, my words, and the viewer's, imagination and their experience, their histories. So some of, you know, these language could mean different things to different people.
Which is interesting. You're mentioning that because this is the concept of projection, or projection as a concept, that we project ourselves onto another.
Correct.
And this is where use of projections was interesting to me as well. And I was wondering if you are playing with that when you use, you know, projection as a physical device, digital video projection, but also using it as this concept of what audience is projecting on the work itself.
Yes, correct. And how we, with our opinions, can cloud somebody. So if you've got to kind of, I suppose, see what Linda has created with this ink splatter, but you get the violence of these drops on Anka's body, but then also you get these beautiful, because as the ink flow gets larger and larger, it cocoons almost like a doona. So it's almost as if the, you know, when I watch it and I read it, I'm reading it as these insults that are flickering on and piercing Linda. And then the more and more that this happens, it actually covers her, and it's almost like the way coercion works. It's what you know, you understand it, and you say, okay, I'm used to this, I know this. So it's kind of, you know, a bit perverse, but that's the way that I read it. Other people might read it as completely different. They might think, oh wow, it's a solace, and that's a cave. It creates a cave for her to find protection in it. So it depends on you know, the childhoods that we are raised in, and the homes that we are raised in, and how we see the world, the lens in which we see violence. And our experience of violence is how we would read that particular projection.
You're on ISED Radio 89.7 FM. This is Arts Monday Sympoiesis. My name is Ira, and we are in conversation with Michelle Santin, who is the artistic director of the Living Room Theatre. We are talking about their latest work, The Seeping Woman, soon showing at the Gladstone Hotel in Dulwich Hill on April the 10th. Michelle, you have mentioned Steve Reich. I know that music is a huge influence for you. In fact, the tune that we played half an hour ago when we started chatting with you is by Ingram Marshall. And it is something that you said that you play in order to get into the dream state, or when you want to dream. Or maybe you can actually elaborate on what you said.
Yeah, it's, I just really, really love that piece, because one of my favorite films is Snow Falling on Cedars. And, you know, the start of that, when I heard this piece by Ingram, I was like, oh, that image, the opening image of that film was there. And so, even though they're totally unconnected, what I love doing is that when I'm feeling agitated, it's usually when there's a work bouncing around inside of me, like it's a physical sensation. And I always call it like a micro cut. So something's hurt me in the world, and I feel quite agitated. And so I have a bath. I get into the bath and I listen to that piece of music, and there's something about the steam from the bath, my breath and my, you know, that sits on the top, the skin of the water. And then when I drop my ears under, inside the water, and this beautiful visceral sensation. And it's something about the familiarity of Ingram's piece that allows me to kind of open the door into that dreaming, which can sometimes for me be a little bit frightening, because my work comes from a place of hurt, something that's hurt me in the world. So I need to kind of have that, if you like, that the arms of this piece, of that piece of music that helps me jump off or enter that world to start writing. Oh, I seem to have lost you, Ira.
No,
are you there?
You didn't lose
so you're
me.
Okay.
I'm just playing a bit of the music.
Oh, okay, sorry, yeah.
But we could also segue from here into the music that you are using in the work itself, and you are collaborating with a couple of musicians, them being Mary Rapp, with whom you worked many times in the past, and your newish collaborator, I believe, Nikki Johnson, who is best known as percussionist, and Mary Rapp, I'm sure many of our listeners know, is a beautiful cellist and vocalist as well. Tell me a bit about, you know, choice to work with Mary again on this work and to include Nikki in this duo, I suppose, that they are creating.
Yeah. So I think, well, Mary and I, we've been working together since 2012. So she seemed like a baby to me when we first started working together. She just recently graduated from the conservatorium and she played cello, and then she's had an amazing career, you know, then became a double bass player, and then does, you know, her alter ego of Mary Hart with her swing stuff, and then her incredible vocals that, you know, stems from singing into waterfalls in Korea. And you know, there's something about her kind of hollow, I think, where she is screaming at the world that it hurts, and there's something about experiencing that live within an artistic context that makes me feel that that's appropriate for us. That is the way to hear women. And so I love that as her skill and her talent, but I love working with Mary because she brings her whole self to my rehearsal floor. And because she knows the way I work, you know, I know I talk about writing, but I also don't like writing a lot of stuff down post rehearsal floor. So I will keep it in my head before I sort of put anything down, because I don't like to be locked in. And that doesn't stress Mary out. She's like, oh, yeah, okay, whatever, you know, I'll create this, I'll create that, and then you'll weave it in, or you'll pull it apart, or you'll cut it, whatever. She's kind of relaxed in my process. She's also incredibly brave, like fiercely brave. So she's happy for me to say, this is what I want, and she will go there for me, or rather for the work, not really necessarily for me, but for the work. She can see where I'm going, trying to go. And then Nikki Johnson, I curated her as part of my Miss Kittredge and Bok Choy jazz series at the Gladstone Hotel. And I suppose I've been following her career and seeing her play in various forms, and there's something quite theatrical about Nikki that I like. And so I programmed her to do a solo set as part of Miss Kittredge, and then Mary did a solo set, and the two of them did an improvisation. And it was during that improvisation between the two of them, I said, okay, this is the soundscape, this is the tension that I want in this work. So yeah, I invited them both, and Nikki uses object as part of her music making. So we've been able to incorporate that as part of our set and our design. There's a beautiful piece of tulle that she uses that now is wrapped. It's wrapped around Anka in almost a sari type of fashion that gets removed and then put onto the vibraphones that Nikki's playing, which alters the sound. So there's something really lovely again about, you know, are they a musician? Are they a composer? Are they a designer? Are they a performer? Mm. That lends themselves to the porosity of in the way that I work.
Mm. Because they are on the stage, as you described. And one question I also had, given that you said that you're reading, that you are the one reading the text, do we see you, or is your voice coming from the unknown source?
I always like to have my amplifier from quite far away from me, so it's not so it's a disembodied voice. And during with the kind of layout of the pub, some might see me and some might. I'll be sitting down. So for those listeners who don't know, I'm 5'1", so I'm pretty teeny tiny. And Anka's she seems to be like 6 foot. So again, it's this height difference that I love playing. So you won't necessarily see me. It's not for me to be seen. It's really about, for me, the intention is for me to be heard, not seen.
Mm. And in terms of music, just coming back to that, what dramaturgical role does the music serve or play, and what kind of overall tone are you hoping to create?
Sorry, what was the second half of that question?
The overall tone, or maybe a color of the work. If you were to think about the work in terms of color, what color would it be?
Yes, and this is the difficult situation. I'm going with grayscale, which I know is like almost anti-color, but to me it is grayscale, because then the colors in the room is what becomes the palette. So it is the color of the carpet on the floor. It is the color of the tulle that we're using, which is a dark navy blue. That then becomes heightened. The tone is, and this is going to sound really, really crude, but from a female point of view, it really is about that moment of menstruation. And I, you know, as a woman, you know, going through menopause where that's not happening anymore, there's that a real abandonment of that rhythm. Mm. And then having conversations with younger girls, you know, it's so frightening for them. You know, like, I don't understand, you know, because it's quite miraculous. Mm. And we all experience our cycles in very different ways. And so there's something about that seepage is the kind of musical tone that I'm trying to create. Now, I know that I gave you a piece, Dove, on that is Mary's piece that you will be playing. Mm. And you know, that's the undercurrent. So we think about menstruating in this particular way. So it, you know, it's watery and it's blobby at times, but then you hear this Mary and that's kind of the guttural reaction, right? So that's that when I'm thinking about the work, I'm thinking menstruation. That's what I'm thinking, and it could be because I long for that. I people go, what, really? And I just said, oh, it's just so fantastic, you know, you just let it all out. It's and it's and I used to always think, wow, this is a miracle, this is like, what is this? It's always fascinated me.
It's certainly connected to the seepage, the theme of seepage. And now I'm imagining music as something that seeps through the space, that's kind of like a waterfall that essentially Mary sings to, but now we are kind of submerged under this water of music.
Yes.
But it also has a very dense quality, because obviously the blood of menstruation is not exactly water.
Correct. Yes, and it's life-forming, right? So that's what it's there for. There's something about the sounds, the way that the women play together, that help us remain stayed in that space, in the way that women are ostracized when they menstruating and have been, you know, we're going to ruin the crops. So there's something about the containment of the sound in that space that I guess is what fascinates me, and the stationary nature and where they're placed in the space.
Mm. You will be able to experience this work on 10th of April in Dulwich Hill at the Gladstone Hotel. This is a work by the Living Room Theatre, and we are here on ESED Radio in conversation with the artistic director of the Living Room Theatre, Michelle St. Anne. And as Michelle said, we have a tune that she selected, and this one is called Dove On by Mary Rapp. And we will wrap up with this tune. Thank you so much, Michelle, for taking time to talk to us on ESED this morning.
Drove.